Okay, today we're down in the Gospel of John, chapter 2, and in verse 13. Now, so far, Jesus has gathered five disciples together. He has gone back up to his hometown of Nazareth. Then they went 4 miles north to the little town of Cana. And there in Cana is where he did his first miracle of turning water into wine. Then they come back down, of course, to Nazareth, to their home. And then they all go down to Capernaum. And that's where we pick up our story today, that they're down to Capernaum and are getting ready now to go down to Jerusalem. It said in verse 13, "And the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem." Now, when it says Jesus went up to Jerusalem, Jesus is about 70 miles north of Jerusalem. And yet the Bible says he went up to Jerusalem. That sounds odd in our language, but of course what he's talking about is altitude. That Jesus went up as far as altitude is concerned. And that certainly is true. When he was up there in Capernaum where he's leaving, why, he was down to really below sea level. And when he gets up to Jerusalem, why, he's going to be up about 2,500 feet above sea level. So he's going to go up to Jerusalem. But now, as we begin to look at this, I want us to review just very briefly some of the things we learned last week so we can get acquainted with the map and we know a little bit about what is going on here geographically. Now, there is one major mountain in all of Israel, and that's called Mount Hermon. And out of Mount Hermon flows a river, and it comes down and goes through the Sea of Galilee and on down about 60 miles south of there into the Dead Sea. Now, the things in the New Testament, the life of Christ, seem to be built around the Jordan River. Several times you will find it mentioned about he does this and he does that. But it's down here in the southern part after it leaves the Sea of Galilee. Now up there is Capernaum, right at the north of that. On up at the very base is Caesarea Philippi, where Peter made his great confession. And then over on the right, and I'm covering this rapidly because we went through it last week. Over on the right side, the east side of the Sea of Galilee, is what is called the Decapolis. That means the 10 cities. And these were the 10 Gentile cities. So that side of the Sea of Galilee actually belonged to the Gentiles. And the Jews didn't go over there. Now Jesus went over a couple of times. That's where he went over and he cast all of those demons out of the swine and or out of the guy that came out of the tomb, and they went into the swine, and the swine ran down the cliff and down into the Sea of Galilee. So the Jews didn't go around there. Now, I do that for this next reason, and that is to show that when the Jews wanted to go anywhere, they went around the Sea of Galilee on this side. It's over on the left side or the west side of the Sea of Galilee when they wanted to go around there any place. Now then, as he's getting ready to go down to Jerusalem, he's going to go from Capernaum down to Jerusalem. And again, last week, we studied about this and how that was a dangerous journey. Now, if you'll notice, they're just a range of mountains, and they're very easy to walk through. It's just kind of a straight line, very easy, where we have that line there. But the country of Samaria is in between Capernaum, or up in the Galilean area, and down to Jerusalem. And in Luke, there we learn that one time when Jesus was going down, it said the Samaritans wouldn't receive him. In other words, they stopped him. They won't let people go down because the Samaritans were enemies of the Jews. And if you were headed down to Jerusalem, they didn't want to help you. They'd stop you. No. You can't go. If you were going back the other way, away from Jerusalem, they'd let you pass through the country. But now, they would stop him. So here's what you find then sometimes as you're reading about this. And that is that Jews would go down and they would cross the Jordan River, go down to the city of Jericho, and then from the city of Jericho, they would travel up a road that's 19 miles long up to Jerusalem. Now, as you get down there at Jericho, here's the problem. The Jericho is 1,300 feet below sea level, and Jerusalem is 2,500 feet above sea level. So what you have then is, you see, about 3,800 feet, which is about the same as Stephen's Pass. It's 4,000 feet. And so you make that steep climb in 19 miles rather than in the 50 miles we take from here to go up there. There's a picture we showed last week of the road. It's just a real desert, and it goes around these cliffs. It's going this way and that way and heads up and goes up for 19 miles there. So the Jews didn't want to go that way if they didn't have to. But sometimes they did have to. Now, in this case, we don't know which route Jesus took. But later on, why, it will make statements there that you can see that they did do these various things right here. So now, as we look at Jesus, he's going down to the city of Jerusalem for his first Passover. Now, this is important for us to see, because John builds his gospel around six Jewish feasts. There's going to be six times that Jesus goes down to Jerusalem. And as we look at these feasts then, which all of them were yearly feasts, it helps us understand how long Jesus actually lived, how long he preached. Now these show that Jesus' ministry lasted a little over 3 years. Unless, and here's the key, unless the feast in chapter 5, verse 1, is not the Passover. Now, when we get to chapter 5, verse 1, it doesn't say what feast it is. It just calls it the feast. Almost everybody says they think it's the feast of the Passover because the feast of the Passover was the feast. It was the feast. It's kind of like the 4th, that we celebrate on the 4th. Now, every month has a 4th. But everybody in here says, if I said we celebrate on the 4th, you'd say, well, that's the 4th of July, because that's the 4th, not just any old 4th. That's kind of what the Passover was. But now we don't know for sure, and I'll show you how that it will make a difference in here. Now, as we look at the life of Christ, so far we've looked but just a short little period of time. We've studied how he was down around Jerusalem and he gathered his disciples together, and then he came up and he went to the wedding feast and he did this. And so we say, how long did it take? I don't know, but it certainly wasn't a very long period of time in there. So we'll throw in just a few months in there. So now that little block will represent the period of time that we've been studying so far. Now then in chapter 2, verse 13, you have a Passover. And then again in chapter 5, verse 1, I've put a Passover. That would be 1 year. Then in chapter 6, verse 4, there's another Passover. That would be 2 years. Then you have two other feasts, Tabernacles and Dedication. And then you have another Passover, and that's a Passover where Jesus died, and that would be 3 years. So by looking at the Passovers, this is the only way we can tell how long Jesus preached. By looking at the Passovers, he would preach then 3 years and just a little over. 3 years and a few months would be what it is. Now this is what almost everybody says. Yeah, that's what he preached there. But look, if the Passover in chapter 5, the feast in chapter 5 is not a Passover, then you go and it would be 1 year from the first Passover over to chapter 6, verse 4. That would only be 1 year, so you're passing that up. If it's not the Passover, then you would have another year down there, and this would mean Jesus preached for 2 years and just a little bit over. So the conclusion, as you look at it then, is Jesus preached either 2.5, I just put in a half, I don't know how long, 3, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months. Jesus either preached a little over 2 years or 3 years, and it all depends on whether the feast in chapter 5 was the Passover feast. So you can see why it's rather important you have there. So did Jesus die when he was 32 or when he was 33? Harry? Yeah. Luke says that he was about 30 years of age when he started preaching. So he started preaching, we know that, when he was about 30 years old. Now, did he preach for 2.5 years or 3.5 years? See, that's the question that you have. That's a question we're not going to answer because nobody knows. You go back and you read, and in the Passover where it talks about the feast, and you go back and, as I said, almost everybody said, yeah, the way it talks, it's kind of like I gave an illustration a minute ago, the fourth. On the fourth, we shoot firecrackers. Well, everybody knows that's the 4th of July because it's the fourth. So, this is not earth-shaking. We don't need to know. It won't help us if we do know. It's just an interesting thing, but it's why sometimes you'll see people say that it's 2.5 and other times maybe 3.5. Any more questions on this little piece of confusion? Okay. If not, he now is going to go down to Jerusalem to the temple. So as we see him go down, let's think about the temple. And here's the artist's depiction of what the temple would look like. A great, tall building, lots of gold around it. They say when people came into Jerusalem and they were up on a hill and looking down, the sun hit that temple, why it just shined out, so there's nothing more beautiful than all the earth. Up there they have a priest that's offering up sacrifices. And so this is the temple within itself. Now, when you walk up, you have what's called the Temple Mount. And that is, you can see that around the temple, it's all built up and walled up, and there's a big area around it. And God planned it this way, for there to be a big area that's around it. So people could go into it in one end or the other up here. There's two entrances. And if you go over there today, why, those entrances are knocked down, but the evidence is still there. It's like somebody knocks that door down and lets it lay out there in the hallway, and 1,000 years, 2,000, you come in, you see that door all laying out in the hallway, and you see a hole, well, you'd say, well, there used to be a door there. So you still have that today. Now, when you get up on that Temple Mount, you have it built around the priest. That's the central part of this whole temple that you've got. Then, around this building, which would be represented by red, you have the court that's called the court for the men. And Jewish men could go in there. Then around that, you have the woman's court. And the Jewish women could go in there. And then around that on out, you have the court of the Gentiles. And Gentiles could go in there. So those were borders that they had around the temple in Jerusalem. To show you a little bit more, here would be a picture you're taking down. The Gentiles could go on the outer edge. The women could go in there. Men could go on in. And then only the priest could go in over in the holy place. That's where the right is. And only the high priest could go in on the left. That's where the holiest of holy is. So Jesus now is getting ready to go down there. And he will be going into the temple. Now, as he goes into the temple, he's going to go in, he's going to cleanse it, he's going to find money changers and merchants and sellers of various things. And that would be out there in the court where the men and the women and the Gentiles are. Out in that area is where he would find these things. So now, he goes down to Jerusalem then in there. And the first thing he does is he's going to cleanse the temple at this Passover. Now, this is going to be his first thing. Now, Jesus would spend this time when he goes down, he would spend at least 8 days at Jerusalem, because the Passover was one day, and then the day after the Passover, they started another day, another feast called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And that feast was a seven-day feast. So here we have here in these scriptures where it tells about it that the two feasts come side by side. And so he's going to spend, I guess you'd say, maybe 8 days in there. Well, I did. I thought it said seven up there. But he's going to spend at least 8 days there if he goes down, waits the feast, and then comes back up. So this is not a quick trip. Now, while he's down there, we're going to learn that he does some things. This morning, we'll learn about one big thing that he does while he's down there. Now, out in this court of the Gentiles and so forth, they had these doves that they would sell. And they had the oxen. They had various animals out there. And when you went up to go down to the Passover, you traveled, a Jew would travel, some of them 600 miles or more. They would travel down to be at this Passover. They had to go down there once a year. In fact, there were three feasts they had to go to, but Passover is once a year. Now, when they went down, they would offer sacrifices. Now, if you had to travel, let's say 100 miles, and you're going to be walking, would you take your oxen or your birds with you? See, you'd say, no, I don't want to take them. I'll buy them when I get down there. And so that's the reason they had these money changers out there. That for all the people that came in for miles and miles and hundreds of miles around, they didn't want to bring and drive these animals down, so they would go in, and the money changers then would sell it to them. Now, here's a problem with the money changers. The money changers increased the price way up. Now, we've got down here, the one historian tells us they would sell a nickel dove, a dove that normally sells for a nickel, and they would sell it for $4. Now, that's quite a markup, you see, that they would have. But you're caught. You need to have something to offer, and a dove is the cheapest that you could get, and so they would jack that price way, way up. Now, at this time, they also had, the priest, what was called a temple tax, and it was a shekel. It's one that you learn about in Matthew, where they came to Jesus, or came to Peter and asked him, said, does your master pay the temple tax? And he said, yeah. And you remember Jesus told him, well, go out and catch fish and open his mouth and take the shekel and go pay it there then for us. And so they had this shekel tax so that the priest would do this. Now, I'm putting this up there to let you know. At this Passover, at every Passover, these priests had so corrupted this thing because of money that it was just unbelievable about all the corruption that you have. Now, Edersheim, a great historian, says that this business alone cleared the priest $300,000 a year. So it would show you that it was a money-making situation. Now then, we're going to learn right here that Jesus is going to do something, and then he's going to quote Scripture, to show what he does. Zeal for thy house shall eat me up. So let's go back now and let's read the story. In verse 14, and he found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money setting. Now, the changers of money would be that if you came in from another country, you'd have to change your Gentile money into Jewish money into the shekel. And of course, they'd charge you for that. And he made a scourge of cords and cast out all of the temple, both the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the changers' money and overthrew the tables. And to them that sold the doves, he said, take these things hence, make not my father's house a house of merchandise. Now, as you look at this, you can see Jesus did something that's unbelievable. The only way to explain how he could do this is miraculous. That is some miraculous way. That when you walk into a place, a big place with all of these merchants making all this big money, and you just start down and you start overturning the tables and driving out their oxen and so forth, how far would you get? You just think about it today. How far would you get in doing something like that? But he did it. Now, he went through, and it's kind of interesting how he did it. And it says, and he took these scourges, whips, and he drove out all the animals. He just drove them out. And so they'd head down those steps and wherever they could go to get out of there. On there, because he was driving out the animals. Their owners could go check them, round them up, keep them, but he drove them out. Now then, he didn't do that with birds, though, as you look at it. He turned around to the guys who were selling the birds, and he says, you take them and get out. Had he opened the cages and let the birds go, the people couldn't have gotten their birds back. So he didn't do that. He drove out the animals, get them. He told the people with the birds, you take those birds and you get out of here. And then he goes by where the money changers are, and he tips over the table. So he tips over the table, and of course, you can get down, you can scrape your money up, because there'd be a money changer here and a money changer over there, and they wouldn't all just be sitting there together. They'd be scattered out so people could get them, and so you could get it. So Jesus didn't go in and ruin their business and do anything of that nature in that way, but he did drive them all out of there. And then he made the statement, and he says, to them that sold the brothers, take these things hence, make not my father's house a house of merchandise. Now that is a big statement. Make not my father's house a house of merchandise. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for thy house shall eat me up. Now when they saw him do that, he had these five disciples at this time, they saw him do that. They're all Jews. They know their Old Testament, forward and backwards. And they remembered that when the Christ comes, it is said of him, zeal for thy house shall eat him up. And so they rightly applied this in that way. So now, Jesus cleansed it out, and now this is the first cleansing. So let's remember this. The first time he goes down, he cleanses the temple. The last time he goes down, he does the same thing. He cleanses the temple again. So he does it on two separate occasions. So now, in verse 18, the Jews therefore answered and said unto him, he said, what sign showest thou, seeing that thou doest these things? So now, they demand his authority. Why do you do these things? And certainly they had a right to demand that authority. Now Jesus had taken over the house that belonged to God, and he had called it his Father's house. They rightly inferred that he was saying that he was also divine, since his Father was God. So by what authority can you make this claim? So they were coming up to him and said, okay, what sign, what miracle can you use to show us you are the divine Son of God? So they're demanding that authority that's there. Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Now, as you're standing there, what would you think? When he said, okay, here's the sign I'm going to give you. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. Now, Did Jesus say, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up? Did he point to himself? Or did he just say it? Now, if he just said it, what would you obviously think about? You'd think about that building. But if he said, okay, here it is, destroy this temple, that would make a distinction. If you pointed and you said, put a little emphasis on this. Here's the temple. What sign? Okay, destroy this temple. And in 3 days, I will raise it up. That throws a new picture on it. I expect that's what he did, that is here. But at any rate, they didn't understand it that way. And they came back in verse 20. The Jews therefore said, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou raise it up in three days? But he spake of the temple of his body. Now, the Jews came back and said, Herod took 46 years to build this temple. Herod, with all of his power, all of his riches, took 46 years. And you're telling us you can do it in 3 days? So they now are looking at the physical temple. And it said in verse 21, but he spake of the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he spoke thus, and they believed the scriptures and the word which Jesus had said. So now, his disciples there remembered, and that's when they really made him a believer. Now, his answer was, here's how you will know for certain I am the Son of God. When I'm raised from the dead, his resurrection. Now, we'll not have time to go into this, but take a whole hour to deal with it. If you go back and you study the things about his resurrection, Jesus always gave his resurrection as the sign. Now, he's going to do hundreds of signs. He's going to do so many that John says you can't even write them down in a book. But of all the miracles he's going to give, there is the miracle that will prove beyond a shadow of a doubt he is the Son of God. In Matthew 16, 1, he answers the same thing. Then you go on over to Luke. When you get into Romans 1, 4 and 1 Peter, there it is, Paul and Peter uses the resurrection and shows it's by the resurrection that you can know for sure. So that resurrection stands separate and apart from all other miracles that Jesus did. So now, this again is just something there that they used it against him at the trial and when he was on the cross. This statement really bugged these people. Even when he's on the cross, when they come around and said, he said he could raise that temple in 3 days. Let him come down off the cross. Just do a little thing like that. And so these people never forgot this thing here that he's talking about like this. Now, in verse 21, here we find that it mentions here about his miracles, and it's only one. In addition, he did many other miracles, so forth. And again, and purpose of this class is not to go into this, but if you look at the effect that miracles had on people, anytime people saw a miracle, their mouth would fly open. It'd be the same thing as you today. If you saw an actual miracle, wow, how did he do that? Miracles were given so that you could know that the speaker, the one who was speaking, was from God. Because God is the only one who could give you the power to do miracles. Now, the last thing we'll look at quickly here today is in verse 23. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed on his name, beholding the signs which he did. So now he's starting to make believers. But Jesus did not trust himself, and I want you to note that. But Jesus did not trust himself unto them, for he knew all men, And because he needed not that anyone should bear witness concerning man, for he himself knew what was in man. So now, many people believed on him. But out of these many who believed on him, he didn't trust himself to them, because he knew what was in man. He knew that men can change their minds just immediately. He understood the fickleness of mankind. And he said, so he didn't trust himself to them. Now here's a little something that we can learn. That is, trust and belief, or faith, in this passage, comes from the same Greek word. The people believed in Jesus, but he didn't believe in them. Or the people trusted in him, but he didn't trust in them. It's the same word. Now here's the key to the whole thing. And that is, faith, the word faith, and by the way, faith and believe mean the same thing. Believe is a verb, and faith is a noun. And so if I have faith, the noun, it means I believe in something. Now, faith or belief is composed of two things, and we can learn that right here. It is an intellectual acceptance of evidence of testimony. Romans 10:17 says, faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. The way I get faith is by hearing God speak. When I hear God speak, I accept it. I believe it. I have faith. But now there's another thing. And that is, will I put my trust in what he says? I believe what he said, but will I put my trust in what he says? If you go to a doctor and the doctor said that you need an operation, a very serious, life-threatening brain operation, and he says, now, I can do that. Well, do you believe him? So you say, well, I believe that I have that cancer, and I believe I need it. And he said he's going in and take it out. Do I really trust him, or do I want to get somebody else? Do I want to get a second opinion? Maybe I should go over to Swedish. Now, if I decide I'm going to go to Swedish rather than up here in the Monroe Hospital and let my doctor do it up here, I don't trust this guy. I really don't believe in him. So before you can say you really believe in God, it means you must hear what he has to say and you accept it as truth, and then you put your trust in it. Now, to make a long story short, God has told you what to do for your salvation, and he's asked you to trust him, and all he asks of you is you give him everything you have. Your life, your body, your mind, your thoughts. You turn it all over to obedience to God. Do you trust him that much? That's what faith really means. Okay, there's where we close today.